What's up, guys? I'm Bob Mata, a recovering criminal defense attorney turned podcaster, and I host the true crime podcast Defense Diaries, which is a serialized deep dive into some of the most prolific cases in the history of criminal jurisprudence. Now, there are deep dive podcasts, and there are deep dive podcasts, and we are the latter. And in season one of the Defense Diaries, the Gacy Tapes, we feature 15 hours of never-before-heard pre-trial interviews between Gacy and his lawyer, my dad, intertwined into a mind-blowing narrative, chock-filled with the interviews of those involved with the case, culminating with the trial of the century. So, if you think you know the Gacy case, think again, because we literally changed the narrative of the case that everyone thought that they knew. So give Defense Diaries a listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Oracle Network.
Welcome to Reverie True Crime. As always, I'm your host, Paige. Churches. They're supposed to be a safe place. People that have a duty to keep us safe are meant to be trusted. Our spouses are also people we trust and love. In this case, everyone is a suspect, and the one place religious people should be able to go and worship without worry turns into a horrific crime scene. Almost as if it was a rare instance of a real satanic ritual. This case wouldn't be solved for decades, and even the son of Sam himself, David Berkowitz, was involved for a time. Let's get right into it. Arliss DeKima, or DeKima, was born on February 22, 1955, in Emmons County, North Dakota. In Bismarck, North Dakota, Arliss and a guy named Bruce D. Perry fell in love in high school. While in high school, Arliss was such a good-hearted person. She was a cheerleader and played on the basketball team. She would bake cakes for her friends and was just so kind. She was known for being a little naive, super optimistic, sweet-natured, and compassionate. She was also described as being way too trusting at times, and some think this could be due to her somewhat isolated childhood. Arliss was a devout Christian and a member of Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Arliss was working in a dental office, and she maintained her activity in the Fellowship of Christian Athletes as the head honcho huddler. When Arliss and Bruce announced that they were going to get married, her mother Jean said that she and her husband Marvin were not too excited about it. They thought Arliss was way too young, and she was even talking about moving to California eventually, because Bruce was going there for college, and her parents thought that was way too far away. However, her parents did start to become more accepting and supported their plans. Arliss graduated high school in 1974, which was 1 year after the two sustained a long-distance relationship while Bruce was a freshman at Stanford University. They had a big, beautiful wedding. Afterwards, they left in the car, and that's the last time Jean and Marvin would see their amazing daughter, Arliss. When Bruce was a sophomore pre-med student at Stanford University in California, the two newlywed sweethearts had been living at the campus in Quillen Hall, where most married couples lived. Arliss really loved the new atmosphere and surroundings. She truly enjoyed it, and she loved taking walks around the campus. However, she did feel lonely at times. Even though she had Bruce, She understandably missed her friends and family back home. A lot of the time, Bruce was not only so busy with school, but he also had a job. So, when he wasn't around and she had alone time, we can all see how that can get a little sad and lonely. Arliss would pen letters to people back in North Dakota, telling them that she was having a hard time meeting people and making new friends. Eventually, Arliss wanted to, understandably, lessen some of the boredom and feelings of lonesomeness. So she started working as a receptionist at a law firm. October 12, 1974. Bruce and Arliss got into a petty dispute, like most couples do. They were walking to the mailbox and they were arguing about their car's tire pressure around 11:30 that night. It wasn't a fight or a serious argument at all. Arliss decided to go to the Stanford Memorial Church to have her alone time and pray. Later that night, much later at 3 a.m, Bruce was worried because Arliss never came home. Around 12:15 or 12:30 that morning, he strolled over to the church and found out that the doors to the church were locked. Bruce walked around the campus knowing she liked to walk around, but he was always nervous about her walking alone and the fact that she didn't really know many people. Though after looking for a long time, he never found her. Bruce knew since she hadn't made a true friend there that she wouldn't have been at anyone's house either. He called the police and reported her missing. He knew this was not like her to just not show up. The police from the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office said they went to the Stanford Memorial Church and the doors to the church were locked. Stephen Blake Crawford was a night watchman on the campus who was also a former Stanford policeman. He was a U.S. Air Force veteran before he started to work at the Stanford Department of Public Safety in 1971. He was later given an option to take a position as a security guard after a new police chief decided to make changes to the department in 1972. He was the one who discovered 19-year-old Arliss's deceased body around 5:40 or 5:45 in the morning on the 13th. The church doors were unlocked at this time, and later police would find out the door had been pried open from the inside. When Stephen called the police, he said, quote, "Hey, we've got a stiff here." Arliss was in the church's east part by the altar. She was lying face up. Her legs were spread eagle, and her hands were folded across her chest, with other sources saying her right arm was laying under her waist. Horrifically, Arliss had an ice pick shoved in the back of her head behind her left ear. The handle of it was even broken off and nowhere to be found on the scene. She had also been strangled, and from the waist down, she did not have any clothes on. A candle that usually sat on the altar, which was 3 to 5 feet long, depending on which source you read, it was used to sexually molest Arliss, still inserted in her vagina. Additionally, there was another candle in between her breasts. Her pants were oddly folded in a diamond shape placed on her legs. To police and others, this did look like some kind of ritualistic killing, or that someone was trying to make a point of some kind. Beside Arliss was a pillow that people kneeled on, and this pillow was found to have semen on it by the investigators. As they kept looking for clues and evidence, they came upon a slight palm print on a candle. Unfortunately, this palm print was not enough to link to anyone. There were three murders in that area that went back to February of 1973. The police investigated this and realized this murder was not in any way connected to those other three. Later, though, these three murders were linked to John Gettro. As we know, the spouse is usually the first suspect automatically. So Bruce was taken in for questioning, passed a lie detector test, and gave a DNA sample. But just from the polygraph alone, it was determined that he was not in any way connected to his wife's death. Now, I hate conflicting reports, but there are other reports that say there was no DNA taken at the time of Arliss's murder, and all of the DNA was taken over the years and given to a crime lab. DNA testing was not even available until the 1980s. Stephen was also a suspect in the case, and at some point, police had gotten DNA from him as well. If they did get DNA before the 1980s and kept it, kudos to them for doing so, since DNA that had been collected before forensics had advanced is now solving so many cases today. There were seven people at least that were in the church during the night and the morning of October the 12th and 13th. Two of them being her husband Bruce and the former police officer Stephen Crawford. Four of the seven people were recognized and were there that night. The other three were not identified. Some said they did see Arliss there that night, and none of these people turned out to be suspects in her brutal murder. There were two people who were leaving the church that night who came forward to say they had just glanced up and saw a younger man, maybe around 25 years old, that was going into the church around 12 that night. The eyewitnesses said the man's hair color was sandy, he was of medium build, wearing a blue short-sleeved t-shirt, and was possibly around 5 feet 10 inches tall. Stephen did tell the police that he had left the church and locked it up a little after 12 that night, and that he had not seen anything strange and there was no one inside. He said he went back around 2 in the morning to check the doors again, and everything was as he had left it 2 hours earlier. When he came back around 5:45 in the morning is when he discovered the dreadful scene. 2 years later, he left Stanford. I must admit, it's hard for me to find jewelry that I'm in love with, but when Ana Luisa reached out to sponsor the show, I looked at their website and instantly fell in love. These pieces go with everything I own, which is impossible for me personally to ever find. I'm mostly a t-shirt and leggings kind of girl, unless I just have to go somewhere and dress up. These pieces work if you're all dolled up or completely dressed down. One pair of earrings I picked out are called Celeste, which are tiny, huggy hoops with a star on one side and a half moon on the other, adorned with tiny sparkling gems that are the cutest touch. Another pair is called Farina. They're chic and dreamy little half moons with clear and pastel gems and linear drops. The necklace I picked is called Nina. It's a vintage, skinny, silver rope necklace with a beautiful, almost see-through, super light, sky blue topaz gem. The quality of these pieces stunned me in the best way. They are sustainable, lovely, and like I said, they're super versatile. They really do have jewelry for everyone, and you can find timeless pieces for someone that you love as well at AnaLuisa.com. AnaLuisa.com. Their jewelry will not break the bank like most places, and that to me is super important. Check out AnnaLouisa.com and use the code TRUECRIME for a discount. That's AnnaLouisa.com and TRUECRIME is the discount code. Oh, by the way, I went back and bought the Sia Link earring. You can buy just one for one ear if you want to, but I was like, no, I want two for both ears. I have my ears pierced twice, so this one was yelling my name. It's a small safety pin that goes in your earlobe, and for your second piercing right above that is a little silver gem, and they're connected by a delicate, pretty chain. It's a little edgy, but still screams contemporary and adorable. AnnaLouisa.com, AnnaLouisa.com, discount code TRUECRIME. Ken Kahn, who is now a retired detective with the Santa Clara Police Department, said what he speculated at the time was, quote, "The perpetrator snuck up behind Arliss, murdered her, and then broke out of the side door. After the murder was discovered, the dean of the chapel was brought in, and he saw the scene. The first impression was, well, this must be the work of the devil." The case went cold, but it was still open. Over the years, it became the biggest unsolved case in the county's history. Later, there was even a connection in the case to Son of Sam, David Berkowitz. David brought up the murder of Arliss Perry in letters, saying he heard about the details of the murder and did suggest that it was a satanic cult. In 1979, out of the blue, David Berkowitz sent a package to Lieutenant Terry Gardner, a deputy sheriff in Ward County, North Dakota. In this package included writings, a picture of someone taking part in devil worship, and a book, The Anatomy of Witchcraft. But what was shocking was a message that was written inside of the book that said, quote, "Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked, and slain. Followed to California, Stanford University." Discovered in the book, there was an underlined part in the book which was written by former Scientologist and Process Church co-founder Robert de Grimston that said, quote, "Thou shalt kill. They say they are dedicated to bringing about the end of the world by murder, violence, and chaos. But they, the chosen, will survive to build a new world of satanic glory." End quote. Just for a quick tidbit, David said that he was told to kill people by a man named Sam Carr, his Labrador, Harvey. Now, Sam Carr's sons, John and Michael Carr, David Berkowitz said he was a part of a satanic cult with them. John Carr was found dead for unknown reasons, shot to death after David said this. And he was dead in North Dakota. People who knew David and John said they were in a cult together. When investigators questioned David Berkowitz, they believed he had nothing of substance and truth to offer. They felt they were just being jerked around by him and being led on a wild goose chase. Bruce Perry did eventually go on to remarry and became a clinician, as well as a researcher in children's mental health and the neurosciences in Houston, Texas. He's still noticed around the world as a huge influence when it comes to children that are in trouble. Finally, in 2018, investigators found new evidence that connected someone to this case. DNA was left on Arliss's clothes, and it was finally able to be tested. It belonged to Stephen Crawford. His motive may or may not have been just pure anger at the university. When he was working as a night watchman at the campus, he was always bitching about it. He was not happy at all about this change and said he did not like what they were, quote, doing to him. It's suspected that he was so enraged that he took it out on Arliss that night. When Stephen was connected to Arliss's murder, police were able to get a search warrant. They started to close in on his apartment on June 28, 2018, around 9 in the morning. At that time, Stephen Crawford was 72 years old. The police confronted him at his door, and before the police could get to him and arrest him, they heard a gunshot. They went inside and saw him laying on the bed, and he had shot himself in the head. According to a statement released by the San Jose Police Department, quote, during the execution of the search warrant, sheriff's deputies made verbal contact at a closed front door with an occupant in the apartment. As deputies made entry, they observed an adult male with a handgun, and the deputies immediately backed away. A short time later, a gunshot was heard. No deputies discharged their weapons. Deputies eventually entered the residence and discovered an adult male with an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. The male was pronounced deceased at the scene. No one else was present or injured. End quote. Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith said, quote, it's been frustrating through the years that we could never get enough evidence to charge the suspect. It's difficult for her family, and it's difficult for our department, but we finally have closure on this case. End quote. After Stephen's suicide, detectives discovered a cover of a book that Stephen had either written or was in the middle of writing called The Ultimate Evil. He briefly did refer to the death of Arliss, and he had written a suicide note just 2 years earlier, after he was questioned by the sheriff's detective about Arliss's ruthless murder. Stephen never came off as a man who could do that to someone, especially to people that knew him. His landlord said he was, quote, a good guy, never had any problems. But she noticed he had, quote, nice bronze statues of horses with what she calls Indians on them. What the landlord had no idea about was the figures were extremely suggestive of crimes that he was arrested for in 1992. Stephen had stolen 200 books and art from Stanford's libraries and the anthropology unit, including Native American artifacts. Of course, even if the landlord did know that, she and others wouldn't exactly think of him as a killer. Many people steal and never kill anyone. Neighbors of Stephen's said that he would strut around sporting a cowboy hat and he walked with a cane. At the time, he didn't have a job, and was living either on retirement or Social Security. Ruby Francisco, who lived right beside Stephen, said the mere thought that one of her neighbors could have had anything to do with a vicious case was distressing. Quote, I'm really scared, I'm shook up, my youngest is 14, she's a little girl. 3 months before they linked Stephen to Arliss's death, her father had passed away. Her mother, 88 years old at the time, Jean, said she was flabbergasted, but she was so relieved to know for sure who killed her daughter. But Marvin, Arliss's dad, and Jean's husband, had died right before he could get the answers to who murdered his baby girl. Jean said it's been so difficult and horrible, and that Marvin desperately wanted to know who took their precious daughter from them. Arliss's sister, Karen Barnes, said at the time her mother was still, quote, struggling with the why. quote, I said, you know, Mom, I don't think we're ever going to know the why, end quote. Jean, as a devout Christian, said, quote, I know there is someone far greater that will punish him. I don't have to do that. Oxygen reached out to the police department in Santa Clara to ask if Stephen Crawford was involved in a cult, but they never got a response. The police did say at one time there was nothing in his apartment that suggested he was, but it's not certain whether he really was or not, and the police are now not speaking on it. Also, due to how gruesome and terrible the murder of Arliss was, could there be more victims? Many suspected he possibly could have been a serial killer. The similarities between Stephen and serial killers that were really active at the time, for example, Dennis Rader and Joseph DeAngelo, they were all fired or downgraded to a lower position in their jobs. They were all in a position of power at some point. Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith is not blind to the possibility at all that Stephen Crawford may have had more victims. Palo Alto Online reports that police found serial killer literature in his home, and Laurie Smith said her department assembled, quote, a chart of unsolved homicides and were looking at when he was living in this area. The same publication listed three unsolved murders in a separate article. They brought up the 1973 strangulation homicide of 21-year-old Stanford graduate Leslie Perlov, who was found strangled to death in the foothills not far from the campus. She had pantyhose shoved in her mouth, and she had a skirt on which was pulled up around her waist. There was a murder later that year of physics student David Levine, who was discovered stabbed to death 15 times right next to the Meyer Library. One more victim, Janet Ann Taylor, who was 21, was found strangled and barefoot in a ditch on Sand Hill Road in early March of 1974. They were all in the same age bracket, and the killings were consistent with strangling or stabbing. Unfortunately, we may never know the answers to that. Arliss is buried in Sunset Memorial Gardens in Bismarck, North Dakota. And that concludes the story of the tragic murder of Arliss Perry. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. And as always, stay safe and take care.